Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Hurricane Dorian delivered only a glancing blow to much of Florida this week after spending a deadly day and a half over the northern Bahamas. It was a wicked storm with wind gusts above 200 miles an hour when it was spinning at its strongest.
Yeah, millions in Florida lived under the threat of Dorian for days, a week even. The eye came less than 100 miles from the coastline, bringing rain, strong winds, and storm surge, but it was a miss. Dorian was the fifth Category 5 storm in the Atlantic in 4 years, joining Matthew, Irma, Maria, and Michael, all names familiar to Floridians. Four of the storms, after all, threatened or hit Florida. Michael Mann is a professor of atmospheric science at Penn State University.
Climate change is making hurricanes more intense, stronger, with larger winds, and with that, larger storm surges, which add to the effect of global sea level rise to give us far worse storm surges to represent quite a bit more coastal risk.
And of course, Florida, with our thousands of miles of coastline, is seen as the most vulnerable state in the nation to the effects of climate change. So we're going to be spending the hour here on the Florida Roundup taking a closer look at that. With Dorian this year, Michael last year, devastating the panhandle, we want to hear from you, Florida, how you're thinking about hurricanes, Florida, and climate risk. Give us a call anywhere you are in the state. The number to join the show is 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800. Tweets to at Florida Roundup as we welcome two experts who study these climactic changes. Dr. Andrea Dutton is a professor of geology at the University of Wisconsin. Until recently, she was at University of Florida. She studies climate change to predict the future of sea level rise. With us from WUFT in Gainesville. And Bob Berwin is a reporter for Inside Climate News, joining the show from Boulder, Colorado. Thanks to you both for being with us. Dr. Dutton, let's begin with you. We just heard from Penn State's Michael Mann, who has emerged as a leading national voice in the realm of climate science. And as we've noted, there have been four Category 5 storms in the Atlantic over the last 4 years. So do you agree with Mann? How much can we attribute warming waters to the frequency of these strong and dangerous storms?
Right, so that's a great question. And in fact, when you heard that clip from Michael earlier, he didn't actually mention frequency. What he mentioned was intensity of the storm. So there's a very direct physical relationship, is that the more you heat up the water, the more intense those storms can get. The other thing that happens is as you warm the atmosphere, it can hold more water. So imagine holding a sponge with a little bit of water and a sponge that's saturated. When you squeeze the sponge, the one with the warmer air that's saturated with water will rain a lot more. So those are very basic physics behind why we expect to see more intense rainfall and more intense hurricanes. The problem, though, with trying to understand, are we seeing a trend? You know, if we look at the past several years or decades of data, is that you only have a certain number of hurricanes every year to look at, a handful or more. And that means that the statistics aren't very good. And so to establish a trend, you need really long time series. So there's actually something that NOAA has posted on their webpage that even if, you know, we were expect to see 100% more, that means double the number of Category 5 and 4 storms in this century, we wouldn't even be able to statistically resolve it until the year 2050.
You know, boy, that's quite.
Yeah, that's
let's not hope.
Long timetable.
No. The evidence can wait, Professor.
Right. So, but the point being is that we may be on that trend. So just because someone's saying we can't resolve it right now doesn't mean that we're not there.
Doesn't mean to ignore where we're going.
Bob Berwin, let me bring you in from Inside Climate News. The other characteristic of Dorian, which struck us all along the east coast of Florida, was the speed or the lack thereof. And we're talking here on this Friday, the clarity of the devastation in the northern Bahamas is becoming ever so clear to all of us here. And of course, the threat remains for Dorian with our friends up in the mid-Atlantic states, even as we speak here. But as the science is getting collected from Dorian, what strikes you, first of all, about the speed of the storm or lack of it?
I can't speak directly to Dorian, but I did, in relation to Dorian, speak with several climate researchers who have, in recent papers, detected a trend of more hurricane stalls by the definitions that they used, which involved proximity to the coast and forward speed translation, they call it. Mm-hmm. And they were very careful to say that they can't see it or identify a direct link to global warming, but that the trend of more hurricanes stalling in coastal areas over the last 50 years is pretty clear to them. And again, they're not saying that, you know, we can say 100% that this is caused by global warming, but they are saying that it does fit with some of the changes to large-scale hemispheric weather patterns that could be driven by global warming. Shifts in the Bermuda High, changes to the jet stream and westerly winds. And again, you know, no direct link. It's really hard, as Andrea said, to pick out a fingerprint signal out of all the noise. But we also have to act on what we do know sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And so the stalling, as scientists and researchers look to ascertain whether warming oceans are slowing down the storms, certainly the stalling of the storm that we experienced, Dr. Dutton, that people in the Bahamas, I should say, experienced, was absolutely devastating. How long it remained stationary and how slowly it moved over those populations. I'd like to get your thoughts about that as well.
I agree. And for anyone watching that or experiencing it, it's just terrifying. It's bad enough that there was a Category 5 hurricane, you know, clocking in with sustained winds of 185 miles per hour. But unlike Hurricane Michael, which tore across the panhandle, moved very quickly, and we all saw the devastation that was left behind that, this hurricane just parked itself and was there for, I think, more than 24 hours. And that's really scary. So we were just talking about increases in rainfall. Well, that will happen anyway with a warmer atmosphere. But if these hurricanes are moving slower or stalling and not moving, there are periods of time when it literally was, you know, technically classified as stationary, mm-hmm. not even moving at all. That will really increase these total rainfall amounts as it just sits there and rains. Mm-hmm. And we all remember seeing that with Hurricane Harvey, too. And so it's one thing, you know, to build a structure that might withstand Category 5 winds. But then you have to ask yourself the next question. Can it withstand that for 24 hours or longer? Which is whole different ball game. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're moving into a new phase, it seems, with the intensity of the storms and the way they traverse the ocean. And we want to get the state's thoughts about this right here now on the Florida Roundup. We want your calls as we speak with Dr. Andrea Dutton and Bob Berwin of Inside Climate News. Give us a call and let us know how you made it through the storm as well. It's 305-995-1800. John is calling in now from Miami Shores. Hey, John, so you've been in the state since Hurricane Andrew, is that right?
Yes, I've been here since, I was here before Hurricane Andrew, but yeah, I remember Hurricane Andrew, the devastation down south. My wife's family, you know, lost a lot of their property and farms down in the Redland. I live now in the coast, or on the east side of Miami, in the Miami Shores area, and I would be terrified about a hurricane that would park itself. I guess I'm assuming that once it reaches some sort of land, it might just stall on the east side and the damage it would do, and I'm actually having thoughts of moving my family more to the inland, thinking that, you know, if it's going to park itself, it might park itself on the coast first. I don't know. Thoughts?
Yeah. Right. John, I appreciate that. And thank you for sharing that. And, you know, Bob Berwin, he's not alone. As people that have loved living on coastlines for many years are looking at the prospect of more intense storms, they're talking about picking up stakes. Increasingly, we hear that from people here in Florida, and it's not just a phenomenon unique to Florida, right?
Absolutely not. I've spoken with with a climate researcher who lived in Tucson, Arizona, was at the university there for many, many years, and recently moved to Michigan. And when I interviewed him the first time after his move, he said one of the reasons he's moving is heat waves and water shortages. And he called himself, only half joking, a climate refugee.
A climate refugee. Yeah, we hear that term increasingly. And I think that's worrisome when you look at the future viability of Florida. Andrea Dutton, you've moved to Wisconsin, but you've spent a lot of years here in Florida. Did you move to Wisconsin because of this? Are you a climate refugee, or was it some other reason that prompted your move to the Midwest?
So that's a great question. And obviously, the big move like that, there are a lot of factors to consider. But climate change was definitely one of them. I spend 24/7 thinking about this, researching it, talking to the public about it. I've looked at those graphs of what it's going to be like in 10 years. And that was definitely one of the reasons. So I would, yes, again, half joking, you call myself a climate migrant. And I know the scientist that you're speaking of, Bob, who went to
Jonathan,
Michigan.
Yeah,
exactly. Right. So, and one point I made to an audience I spoke to in Miami recently is, even if you just look at heat, right, the most direct effect of climate change and how that is changing, and the number of days you have, say, over 90 degrees. So in Miami, the number of days over 90 degrees has increased by about 73 days since 1970. So it started at about 40 days a year. Now it's well over 100 days a year. And by the year 2030, we expect danger days where we have a heat index of 105 to be at about 126 days a year in Miami. That's about 1 in 3 days. Imagine trying to do any work outside
right
in when the heat index of 105
I'm
degrees.
Thinking of my walk to the bus stop, and I've gotten very used to carrying an umbrella, not because of the rain, but because of the sun, trying to create any kind of shade. And in July, as we've seen, the statistics, the data show the hottest month on record, and we have seen a significant increase in those heating days and heating hours here in Florida. And as research shows, when you don't get that cool off at night, it not only obviously is an inconvenience, it becomes a public health challenge.
Yes.
Because you're not allowing the human body really to cool off at night. We got a lot of phone calls here across the state asking various questions about the strength of storms and the influence of climate change in Dunellen and Marion County. Joe on line 5. Go ahead, Joe. You're on the radio.
Hey, great to be here. Hey, I got a question in intensity. A lot of stuff is with the anthropogenic climate models that show that humans are actually adding to this, but none of the science is backing it up. If you go back into the 40s and 50s, we had 12 hurricanes a year. In the 70s and 80s, it dropped down, and now it's coming back
up. So, Joe, let me just kind of clarify your question here. Are you asking about the intensity of the storms? In other words, each individual storm strength, or are you asking about the frequency, the number of storms in a storm season?
The cycle of intensity that come and go. The worst storm.
I'm still unclear what you mean. I'm sorry to interrupt, Joe, but just again, the strength of the storm or the number of storms?
The graph that shows the intensity and the frequency is the same as it's been through history. Nothing's changed.
That's not true. That's not true,
okay.
Though, Joe. I mean, when you talk to climate scientists, they would rebut that. But go ahead, Dr. Dutton.
So I can answer that. So again, we mentioned this a little bit earlier in the show. When you look at frequency, even with the models that may project the global warming, the frequency of the hurricanes usually is expected to stay about the same or even decrease a little. So that's the number of storms, right? But it's the intensity that we're really worried about. That will increase as a direct effect from the warming temperatures in the atmosphere and the ocean. And having really more of really strong storms is something to be even more worried about than just the number of storms, I think.
I hope that explains it for him, because I've gotten a lot of questions about that here in Jacksonville as well. People saying, well, it's hurricane season. What's the big deal? But as you look at these data points over many decades, this consensus, Bob, increasingly is, yes, we're always going to have a certain number of hurricanes, but we're very concerned about the escalating intensity of these hurricanes. correct?
And I guess I would, my partial answer to that question would be is, number one, there's a few different ways to measure intensity, the strength of the wind speeds, the, you know, whatever it is on the Saffir-Simpson
barometric
scale.
Barometric pressure, sure.
Right, exactly. And there's also rainfall, which is obviously one of the most dangerous factors associated with hurricanes. And in that particular metric, there have been a number of studies the last few years on Florence, on Harvey, that have made a direct attributable link to the amount of rain that comes from one particular storm. It's called attribution climate science, and that's pretty good science. So, you know, that's one metric where you could probably say pretty clearly, as has already been discussed here, that global warming is fueling storms with more rainfall.
But I'm wondering if this is a nuance that either isn't being picked up or if you think that it's being ignored. I mean, Joe's question seemed to conflate, in my opinion, Joe, apologies, but I think it was combining both the strength of the storm as well as the frequency of the storms. But, you know, frankly, is that a nuance that the general public is just lacking the willingness to grasp?
Let me answer that, even though I'm not a subject matter expert. Let me jump in, because this poll was just sent to us. It's an AP poll. Nearly three quarters of Americans now see weather disasters like Hurricane Dorian worsening, and most of them blame climate change to some extent, confirming scientists like Dr. Dutton and researchers like you, Bob. So at least going off this poll, the public is aware increasingly about this.
But part of the reason there's this confusion is there is an intentional campaign of misinformation out there, and people attempting to put these statements out there. As I say, see, look, the frequency's going down. You must be wrong. And we have to keep backpedaling and say, no, that's not what we're saying. We've already done that a couple times, you know, just in the past 15 minutes or what. So there's a reason that it's getting confused, and because there's, you know, campaigns of people out there who are in denial, or in that denial, it might be fueled by, you know, maybe they don't want to admit that this is happening, right? And that's something we haven't touched on either, is the emotional impact of everything that we are seeing now and expecting in the future. Even though we had a near miss this time, a lot of us were thinking back to Matthew again, where we saw similar behavior off the coast of Florida. What is the effect on the mental health of Floridians, these people, as we prepare for these storms? And sometimes we get bad effects even when the eye doesn't land. So all your relatives might be like, oh, you were fine, you know, didn't make landfall. Yet there may be a lot of beach erosion or coastal flooding. People are still recovering from some of these hurricanes and rebuilding, even though maybe it didn't make landfall right near them. And so that's an aspect that I would like to see a lot more discussion about, is people talking about how it's impacting them and how they feel about it and whether they talk to their friends about that.
Bob.
It's why, honestly, why we decided to spend the hour on it today, Bob.
And I would add also that science is nuanced, and science is constantly progressing and advancing, and that shouldn't keep us from acting on the things that we do know. Andrea talked about the length of time the storm spent over the Bahamas. I interviewed relief workers a few years ago about Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines, and they told me about folks there who were properly warned, and they went to shelters that they had always used for the most intense storms, and some of them died in those shelters because the intensity of that storm was such that it was just unexpected, and they weren't prepared for
storms.
It.
Yep. Well, we need to get to a break, but we want to thank you both, Dr. Andrea Dutton of the University of Wisconsin, Bob Berwin of Inside Climate News. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. In a moment,
how the response to climate change plays politically here in Florida. You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Thanks for listening this week. It looks to be a much quieter weekend for Florida weather compared to last weekend, certainly. There are still a couple of systems the National Hurricane Center is tracking out in the Atlantic. We are, after all, in peak hurricane season. Of course, no state is more vulnerable to these kinds of storms than Florida. We're also experiencing some of the effects of climate change, like higher seas. Some local governments across the state are spending hundreds of millions of dollars in tax money battling higher seas or stormwater flooding. And at a state level, the term climate change, remember, it was banned by the Scott administration. Governor Ron DeSantis has now hired a chief science officer and created the Office of Resilience and Coastal Protection while pushing to spend hundreds of millions of state dollars on the environment.
Florida getting more serious about resiliency and confronting this huge existential threat to the state more than it has in the past. However, some Florida politicians say these moves don't go nearly far enough. They want Florida to embrace an aggressive climate change agenda and move the state more fully into renewable energies as just one piece of it. We're going to talk about the politics now here on the Florida Roundup. And your calls in just a few moments. Call us up. It's 305-995-1800. Tweets to at Florida Roundup. We are welcoming Florida lawmakers to the show now from both sides of the aisle. In a few minutes, we'll welcome State Representative Heather Fitzenhagen, a Republican from Fort Myers. First, though, let's go to State Representative Anna Escamani, Democrat of Orlando. She's with us from WMFE Studios. And Representative Escamani, you've put forward legislation calling for all of Florida's energy to come from renewable sources by the year 2050. You also say we need to go to 40% renewable energy in just about 10 years, in 2030, on the part of state agencies, universities, and state colleges. How do we get there? How hard a hill is this to climb, given that there isn't bipartisan agreement in Tallahassee on the imperative to do this?
Yeah, the future is ours. Thank you so much for inviting me to talk about this, too, and just for keeping the hour to such an important issue. My heart is with the families in the Bahamas. And as we have this conversation, it very much is grounded in the notion of the personalist political, that if we don't push forward on these issues, more people are going to lose their lives and more people are going to be damaged by these extreme weather patterns. Our bill, House Bill 97, to your point, would establish a goalpost for Florida to be 100% renewable energy based by 2050. It very much is an intention to create public-private partnerships to get to that goal. But as most folks probably know, majority of Florida's energy to this day, though we are the Sunshine State, comes from natural gas and coal. It's actually less than 0.4% of our energy from 2017 comes from solar. So we have potential. We're the ninth state with the most potential to expand solar, and yet we've dragged our feet on this. And because we don't have any type of renewable goal, we're going to continue to drag our feet on it. And as the scientists already painted the picture, the situation is urgent. So that's why we are refiling this bill from last session with the hope of securing Republican co-sponsors as well, so we can actually get this thing passed.
Here's a tweet for you from the Florida Efficiency Report. They're tweeting the show right now. The tweet reads, 100% renewable is 0% passable. What about that?
Well, I don't think we run for office to talk about what's been possible. We run for office to push forward the possible. And in this case, we've seen six cities actually make this commitment, including the city of Orlando, the area that I represent. But even cities like Largo, over 90 cities across the country, Republican and Democrat, have made this commitment to be 100% renewable energy based. And I think folks have to remember that it's not just about where your energy comes from. It's also about efficiency of your buildings, efficiency of our cars, renewable energy, and becoming a clean state. This new economy we're pursuing, it doesn't just focus on moving away from fossil fuels. It's a much larger picture of resiliency and efficiency of our buildings a part of the conversation, because that reduces the energy need overall.
Representative, it's Tom Hudson. A number of cities, Orlando, for instance, has made a pledge about renewable energy, but it's about the usage of energy by the city. It's not by the residents that the goal is. Is your goal that all Floridians receive energy from renewable sources? Or is it your goal that the state of Florida and the energy usage that the state uses comes from renewable sources?
That's a great question. Our intention is for the entire state of Florida to be grounded on 100% renewable energy. But if we start with our state agencies, our public schools, our cities, that's a step in the right direction. But the world that we envision is one where we can move completely off fossil fuels, reduce our energy consumption by using cost-benefit analysis and energy efficiency tools to ensure that our energy usage is decreased as well, so we don't actually have to produce as much energy as we do today.
Does it include getting rid of or doing away with nuclear energy, which is a key source of electric generation?
That is up to debate. Some people consider that to be a more sustainable
How
source
do you
of
follow
energy.
That debate, though?
Well, for the bill that we filed, it actually gives a lot of flexibility because our intention is not to tie people's hands. What the bill simply does is directs the Office of Energy within the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, in consultation with other public state agencies, to develop this statewide plan, and the plan to be brought forth to the governor and to others to then map out what is going to have to be other policies to fit that plan.
And let's get a Republican point of view on this now as we welcome State Representative Heather Fitzenhagen, Republican of Fort Myers, with us from WGCU. Representative Fitzenhagen, let's begin by asking your reaction to your colleague's bill on renewables. As we've been noting, it doesn't really have strong bipartisan support. So can common ground be found in Florida on this issue?
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon, and good afternoon to Representative Escamani. I think that it is a very good goal, and I think that her bill is very well intended. I don't know if we'll be able to get the kind of support that will allow it to pass, but I, like Representative Escamani, do believe that we should be moving closer to clean, renewable energy in Florida by both the state and its residents. But I think it's a mindset. So by merely passing bills, we wouldn't necessarily be achieving the long-range goal. I think we have to educate and change the mindset of Floridians over time.
And how do you see your role in accomplishing that and the role of legislators in Tallahassee who can affect policy? Also, I'd like to ask you, what's your response to critics of the leadership in Tallahassee? They see the leadership there as too beholden to fossil fuel interests.
Well, let me say this. I think that fossil fuel has been something that has been affordable and available, and we are using it, and the supply is very large at this point. So it's not something that I don't think that we should not use at all, but I do think that moving forward, it's a good idea over time, because I'm talking about generational change to look at renewable energy and making it attractive cost-wise and easy to use, and so that people will embrace the idea of leaving fossil fuels, as we may find that we are less and less able to continue to produce the quantities of fossil fuels that we're now using.
Representative Fitzenhagen, it's Tom Hudson. The role of government and policy can help certainly steer a market. We've seen that in many different kinds of markets. What is the role that you envision for the state of Florida, given your interest and acceptance that you would like to see energy generation move away from fossil fuels in the state of Florida?
Well, I do not think that the state is in a position to dictate public opinion by what we do,
I'm not asking about public opinion. I'm talking about public policy, though, with specific policies that you would advocate that would move the needle on this idea of Florida getting more renewable energy.
If we can't go to 100% renewables by 2050, what is doable and how do we get there?
Well, that's a very good question. I have not filed a bill, and I have not studied Representative Escamani's bill. However, I do think that we have a goal that we could create of moving in the direction maybe 25% renewables, trying to get companies to embrace the idea of renewables, because the private sector is using the energy. Children are learning in schools about energy. We can't change it overnight. So I think we have to have a more reasonable short-term goal and try to find a way to make it more attractive to use renewable energy. It's about marketing the idea of why it would be a benefit to Florida.
So not necessarily any kind of quotas for energy generation coming from renewable energy that you would advocate, but what, more of a marketing plan?
Well, you know, again, I don't really always believe in quotas because those are artificial numbers. Mm-hmm. I think, as I said at the outset of the conversation, I think we have to change the mindset that the idea of using renewables is a better choice in the long run because it's cleaner, it's healthier, we're less reliant on sources of energy that can be depleted over time. So I think it's an education, but it's also something that our private sector has to embrace. The top people at the corporations that we deal with, the businesses that are, signing paychecks here in Florida, mm-hmm. have to want to participate. And so it has to be a balance between what we as legislators do.
Mm-hmm. And what business does. And so Representative Anna Escamani, let me bring you back into the discussion. We hear your Republican colleague expressing moderated support for what you're saying. What about her perspective that the goals you're setting out in your bill might be too aggressive to bring business interests along? What about that?
Well, I first really appreciate sharing space with Representative Fitzhagen. We're good colleagues. It's great to have you here. That gives me a lot of hope, to be honest, because, obviously we want our bill to pass. We want to have a goalpost. We have no investor-owned utility company that ever approached us last session to even have the discussion of adjusting a goalpost to meet what they feel like is possible. But the reality, too, is that we have to do what's possible in the midst of a crisis. And so that's why, replicating what our cities are doing and try to match those goalposts, I think there's a lot of value to that. But of course, if we were to set a goalpost and we hit 10 years, we're not there yet, there's always an opportunity for legislature to adjust. But I do want to add to the points about market opportunities, because I do think that we've seen other states opportunities to increase efficiency, reduce a carbon footprint through different programs that either incentivize utility companies to move in that direction by supporting them in a ROI. There also is the reality that the Public Service Commission at this time does not have actually any type of incentive program that's robust enough to encourage our fossil fuel companies to move quickly in that direction, nor do they have programs for mm-hmm. Floridians to practice efficiency. And actually, as we speak, the Public Service Commission is deciding to reduce some of their efficiency standards, which would be detrimental to the work that we all want to lead together. And one final thought, too, is there has been a growth of more conservatives supporting this issue. There actually is an organization called Conservatives for Clean Energy. And their motivation, it's not necessarily altruistic, though I do think we have to talk about not only infrastructure and water levels rising, but public health. But this is also an economic issue. And most recently, we know real estate is being impacted along the coast because of climate change and the lack of resiliency for our communities. And then even Moody's, most recently, one of the nation's larger
credit rating agency.
They have recently purchased a research firm that does research on climate change resiliency, and they're going to be integrating that to assessing if a borrower is credit worthy. So it's coming into all parts of our life.
It's becoming a dollars and cents matter in many aspects, and you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
305-995-1800, the phone number. Steve in St. Pete on line 4. Go ahead, Steve. You're on the radio.
Yes, I just wanted really to comment on the Republican representative statement. She talks about generational change and how we have to get businesses in line, and we'll teach children about it in schools, and really no sense of the urgency, which we just is all around us. We do not have generations to wait. I'm 77 years old, and by the end of my generation, I've seen absolutely no movement in Florida whatsoever. And the legislature seems more than willing to pass all kinds of legislation that impacts every Floridian. And I would suggest that the mindset needs to be the mindset of the legislature, not wait around for everybody else to make up their mind.
Steve, we got it from St. Pete. Thanks for joining us. Representative Fitzhagen, how about the sense of urgency that you hear from Steve?
Yes, thank you. Well, I was strictly keeping my comments to the uses of renewable energy. So he may be talking about urgency on other things, which we may be very much aligned on. So I think that there is a sense of urgency, but I don't feel as strongly as it has to do with renewable energy. I think we have a path to have more gradual change in that area. If he's talking about climate change and water levels and clean water and things of that nature, I would agree that the urgency is much stronger.
Regarding sea level rise, for instance, that is an effect of carbon in heating in the environment, and coming from the burning of fossil fuels, leading us back to the question about efforts toward using more renewable energy as opposed to fossil fuels, though. Is that a linkage that you reject, Representative Fitzenhagen?
No, I don't reject the linkage, but I don't believe that we can, as a state or as a planet, be able to make that kind of 100% turn to stop the use of the fossil fuels. So while I am very much aware and sensitive to it, know that we need to do things, I in fact, a point, don't think it's realistic to think.
Let
that
me
we
ask
are
you, Representative, what about the science? What about the scientific consensus that we've got about 12 years to enact the kind of wholesale structural changes that can avoid the worst impacts to this state and to the world? That's a short time frame. Do you disagree with that tight time frame?
I don't know if that's the exact time frame, but let's say for sake of argument that it is, and that's one that all scientists agree with. I do think we have an opportunity in this very short window to make some significant changes. I don't believe we are going to be able to completely eradicate the problem that we have created over time in Florida and other places. But we do have to make significant steps, and I do believe that we have that climate change is a reality and that it is going to very detrimentally impact Florida.
It's a fascinating discussion right now as we're speaking with Democrat Anna Escamani of Orlando, and it's a bipartisan discussion. We also so appreciate Representative Fitzenhagen joining us from Fort Myers and WGCU, and your calls. In a moment, did you catch that 7-hour climate town hall on CNN the other night? 7 hours. How climate change is driving the presidential race, and will it make an impact here in Florida in this swing state? That is coming up next. This is the Florida Roundup on Florida Public Radio. Give us a call and tweet us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Well, just as Hurricane Dorian was leaving Florida's shores Wednesday night, an extraordinary 7-hour-long climate town hall aired on CNN that featured all of the major Democratic presidential candidates.
If you remember, it was just a couple of months ago, there were a lot of calls for a climate change-focused conversation with the Democratic presidential hopefuls. Both moderators and members of the audience held the candidates' feet to the fire, trying to find some significant, real meaningful answers and solutions to the climate crisis. One question was lobbed at the way of the front runner, the former Vice President Joe Biden.
How can we trust you to hold these corporations and executives accountable for their crimes against humanity when we know that tomorrow you are holding a high dollar fundraiser hosted by Andrew Goldman, a fossil fuel executive?
Well, I didn't realize he does that. I was told if you look at the SEC filings, he's not listed as one of those executives.
So how do you feel?
It was
feel?
Interesting, yeah. You know, I was just going to say, Tom, it was interesting to see that Joe Biden apologized and said that he would no longer participate in the fundraiser if it could be shown that that gentleman had links to the fossil fuel industry. So that gives you an idea of where the Democratic primary audience is on this, but not necessarily where swing voters or Republican voters are on this, right?
Yeah, absolutely right. And of course, Florida playing a significant role in the 2020 election cycle with the presidential primary coming up in the springtime. We're talking about the politics of climate change and the environment here in the Sunshine State. 305-995-18. 1800. Is the environment, climate change an issue for you at the ballot box? Let us know at 305-995-1800. A couple of state representatives are along with us. A Democrat from Orlando, Anna Escamani, is along with us, and Heather Fitzenhagen, a Republican from Fort Myers. Thanks again to both of you for sticking around here. Politics is often thought of as the art of the possible, not the probable, but the possible. So as you're having this discussion, as you heard from the Democratic candidates, for instance, the debate around climate and the response from the federal government that we're likely to hear in the 2020 cycle, Representative Fitzenhagen, what is possible in the state of Florida with your colleagues as you go back to work with committee weeks coming up in just the next few weeks, but of course the legislative session in January? Representative Fitzenhagen, you still with us?
Oh, might have lost her. Representative Anna Escamani, still with us in Orlando. Let me get your take on this from the Democrats. It was extraordinary to see these candidates on the CNN stage putting out these detailed policy proposals on climate change. To be a competitive Democrat now running for president, you need to be as woke as possible on this issue, right? I know, but Republicans are working to define the Democrats on this negatively.
Yeah,
we heard a lot about GOP strategists saying the Democrats want to ban hamburgers. They want to ban our plastic straws. They see that as a win for the president. At the same time, there's been this spectacle this week of President Trump doubling and tripling down on his insistence, which is inaccurate, that Hurricane Dorian was threatening Alabama. Mm-hmm. I mean, this has become an unbelievable scene. My question to you is the push for aggressive climate change response a winner or a liability for the Democratic Party, particularly in a swing state like Florida?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a winner, and for a few reasons. I mean, one, it was already mentioned, the polling around this issue, how more and more Americans believe that human behavior is impacting the earth and in a negative way. And so there is this understanding that we have to be responsible for this one planet that we all live in and breathe on. And that can take shape in many policy proposals. But I think the fear mongering is really a distraction because the majority of Americans do support that. And I know in Orlando and across the state, we see more and more Teslas. We see more and more electric vehicle charging stations. We see those who can afford it, placing solar panels on their home, attaching battery storage onto their homes as their backup. And we're also realizing that if we truly had a free market for energy in Florida, I think we would see the growth of solar. But knowing that we have a really regulated system with major investor utility companies that not only have monopolies in place, but they're huge political donors. And I do think that this point around Vice President Joe Biden not going to this fundraiser speaks to the pressure to not give in to crony capitalism, and that Republicans and Democrats are tired of money in politics, are tired of major corporations getting what they want because they are major donors. And I'll tell you, on our campaign, as a first-time candidate, we signed very early on the fossil fuel-free pledge, which was our commitment to not take any money from these corporations. And I do think that was a big deal for our district. You know, our district is a swing seat, but I think the fact that we were really intentional in saying we're not engaging with these companies in that way. Our door is open to everyone to share their ideas and to solve problems together, but we're going to put a line in the sand on who influences us.
How easy is that, though, in Florida, where there's very little fossil fuel activity, a lot of burning of fossil fuels, but not a lot of drilling? I mean, there's been obviously debate around it, though, Representative.
Correct.
But you know, I mean, how easy is it to reject the fossil fuel money in the state of Florida when there's not a lot of native fossil fuel money here?
You gotta start somewhere. That's the reality of it. And I encourage all my colleagues that, you know, we have to be really brave and courageous and in saying no and fighting for values, not because of who influences us by their financial contributions, but fighting for values of what is best for our state and the interest of our Floridians. But I will say, again, it goes back to this lack of free market, because it is very difficult for solar companies to come into Florida and to expand. We don't have, for example, power purchase agreements in Florida. Net metering, not to get too much in the weeds with our listeners, but net metering is basically grounded in ROI. If I have solar panels on my home, and there are some utility companies at the municipal level that are reducing the
JEA
ROI.
In Jacksonville has made it more difficult homeowners to do net metering, and that is not going over well in North Florida, with advocates of wanting to tap into solar power. The incentives aren't really set up the way they need to be in large parts of the state.
Correct.
So that people can move in that direction. You're right about that.
Correct. And everyone needs to always remember that those who are most directly impacted are going to be those who have the least. And we saw that with Hurricane Maria, Hurricane Michael, Hurricane now Dorian, that communities who are actually contributing the least to climate change and who have the least resources to escape the disaster that comes with it are the ones who are most directly impacted.
Referring to the Bahamas here, certainly. Let's remind folks that you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Heather Fitzenhagen is back with us on the telephone, Republican representative from Fort Myers. Representative, apologies for the scheduling mess up there, but we're glad to bring you back into the conversation here.
Thank you.
What is possible as you're hearing from your Democratic colleague in Orlando? The legislative session committee meetings are beginning in just the next few weeks, if not sooner, and the legislative session coming up during an election year. Is there something possible on renewable energy from the legislature in 2020?
I believe that there's something possible, and I think that Representative Escamani is obviously a very strong advocate, and we have been able to work together on issues in the past. And I think that I strongly encourage her to keep being the zealous advocate that she is for renewable energy. And I would like to be able to support that with her, because I think it is something extremely important for our state. And I think that we need to put pressure on the overall legislature to understand that we don't have a lot of time, and Florida needs to embrace these concepts.
When you're talking about...
I hear... It's interesting, Tom. I hear both of these representatives being almost on the same page, but we're not seeing that kind of consensus in the state capitol, unfortunately.
Well, and I'll add to Melissa, we've been working really hard for Republican co-sponsors on our bill, and I have a few leads. And I do encourage all listeners, if you do support this effort, to, you know, call your House representatives, ask them to co-sponsor House Bill 97. We need everyone to join us in this effort. No one has to be left behind on this conversation. It really is all encompassing, and it will make the state safer, more economically viable for generations to come.
Representative Fitzenhagen, is there common ground? I mean, what do you find yourself agreeing with your Democratic colleague that you could support in the legislature? It's one thing to agree with them on the steps of the Capitol, but what can you agree with them in the chambers?
Well, again, I have not studied Representative Escamani's bill, and I will do that. But what I will say is, while I'm a Republican, I am a green Republican, if you will. I have made a career out of working on water issues. I do fundamentally agree with the energy issues that we're discussing on the call. It really comes down to fundamentally what exactly are we going to do about it, and when, how much, and who is it going to impact, because I'm also, as a Republican, very sensitive to the economy of Florida, the business climate of Florida, which drives, you know, the whole engine of the Florida lifestyle. So I have to look at it through that lens.
Unique dynamics in this state in that regard, for sure.
Which is really fueled by tourism and the hospitality industry, which is a significant contributor, obviously, to the overall economy. Heather Fitzenhagen, Republican representative from Fort Myers, thank you so much for your time, Representative. And Anna Escamani, Democratic representative from Orlando. Representative Escamani, nice to have you on the program as well. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Great discussion. And let's quickly make mention of the fact, as you've been listening to the show all over the state, go to your local public radio website, whatever city you're in, for more information on how you can help with Dorian relief efforts, particularly in the Bahamas. Stations all over the state have links on their website giving all of us information on what we can do to help out where we can. So check out all those websites WLRN, WMFE, WJCT, WUFT, WUSF, WQCS. I think I got them all. And that is our show for today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are our producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming, also our Technical Director for this hour. The Director of Radio Operations at WLRN is Peter Meritz. Engineering help today from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Brady Corum. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Thanks to all the callers and tweeters here. Sorry we couldn't get to everything. I'm Tom Hudson.
I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next Friday at noon.